America was founded primarily by those seeking religious freedom. Colonel John Eidsmo is a Christian law professor and author on the subject of church-state relations, and recently wrote an article about a church-state case out of Louisiana, Spell versus Edwards. He notes in that piece, quote, in 2011, Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas decried an Establishment Clause jurisprudence in shambles. Unable to come to a consensus, the court has shifted from one theory to another with confusing, conflicting, and sometimes bizarre results. Over the past several decades, the court has struck down school prayer, 1962, and Bible reading, 1963, but allowed prayer at town board meetings, 2014, prohibited, 1948, but later allowed, 1952, release time programs whereby children could be released from school for religious instruction, prohibited the display of the Ten Commandments in schools, 1980, but in 2005 prohibited the Ten Commandments in a courthouse, but on the same day allowed them on a state capitol lawn, allowed 1984, but later prohibited 1989, a public nativity display. I'm getting dizzy, John, just reading all these things. In short, what in the world does the Supreme Court mean by the Establishment Clause? What in the world did the Founding Fathers mean by it? And what is this new case called Spell versus Edwards out of Louisiana? What impact is that to church-state relations in America? I'm Jerry Newcomb. This is Vocal Point, and we welcome John Eidsmo back to the program. He's the one I was just quoting a moment ago. John, it's amazing when I just read portions of your article here, you just realize it's almost like it's true. The Establishment Clause interpretation of the Establishment Clause by the Supreme Court depends on maybe what they ate for lunch that week or something.
It depends a lot on who's in the majority at a particular time. And plain fact of the matter is, we've had a sharply divided Supreme Court with some on the very liberal side, some on the very conservative side. And so you have some who have been honestly trying to look to what the intent of the framers was. You have others that don't really care about the intent of the framers. And anyway, so since there's been no majority on the court, you have some decisions that allow religious liberty, some that suppress religious liberty, and Justice Thomas is absolutely correct in his Utah decision there, where in his dissent, he simply said that our Establishment Clause jurisprudence is in shambles. Now, in the last decade or so, we've started to see the court move toward a more accommodating view of religion. The several cases, for example, the American Legion versus American Humanist Association, where the court said that a 30-plus foot cross that was standing on a public thoroughfare in Maryland to honor servicemen who died in World War I, that this was not an establishment of religion and could stand, and court allowing prayer at the beginning of town hall meetings there at in Greece, New York. Greece is a town in New York that this issue came up in. And more recently, the Coates-Kennedy case, where the court said that since you allow people to say other things, the fact that this coach wants to go out to the 50-yard line after every game and kneel in silent prayer, that is not an establishment of religion, and you can't discriminate against his form of speech, religious speech, while allowing other forms of speech. And so we're seeing the court move away from some of that radical separationist approach that we'd seen in the 1960s and moving toward a little more accommodation. But recently, in the Kennedy case, the court announced, Justice Gorsuch writing the opinion, that the old Lemon test that the court had been using had been overruled, and that the court is now going to be looking to the intent of the framers and to the historical situation in determining what the Establishment Clause means.
That's exciting. That's very exciting. Yeah.
Definitely. Because, of course, that's what they should have been looking to the whole time. But a lot of the Establishment Clause cases start to come right at the time when we see this talk about a living constitution or changing constitution. And plain fact of the matter is, a living constitution is no constitution at all. If judges are free to shape it to mean anything they want it to mean, then it is no protection at all for anybody's rights. But anyway, we have a case where we're hoping that we can get the court to go back to the intent of the framers. As far as the establishment and pre-exercise clauses are concerned, then the case is Spell versus Edwards out of Louisiana. John Bel Edwards, of course, is the governor of Louisiana, and at the time of the COVID crisis, he issued a series of executive orders that were based on the Emergency Powers Act, in which he restricted various types of activity, and among other things, he restricted church worship services if more than 10 people were in attendance. Tony Spell is the pastor of a large church, a church that has over 2,000 members, and obviously they couldn't hold worship services if they restricted them to 10 people, and so he decided that we must obey God rather than men, according to Acts 5:29, and continue to hold services, as a result of which he was arrested and charged with several misdemeanors for violating that executive order. He came to the Foundation for Moral Law because he saw in the Foundation somebody that took a uncompromising position in interpreting and defending the First Amendment, which was his position as well. And as we examined his case, we determined that he was in fact sincere and that he was willing to stand for what he believed. And so we undertook his defense. And the case really followed two tracks. One was in the state court. That's where the criminal charges were, where we defended. The other was in federal court, where we filed lawsuits, where we went on the offensive, arguing that the governor's orders were unconstitutional. Among other things, we noted that Louisiana has a unique provision in its Emergency Powers Act. You know, every state has an Emergency Powers Act, but Louisiana had a unique provision that was attached to the act by a Christian state senator that simply said that nothing in this act shall authorize the state to take any action which violates the rights of people under the U.S. and Louisiana constitutions. And I might just add quickly here for all of our listeners that every state needs to have a provision like that in its Emergency Powers Act. If yours doesn't, I'd urge you to contact your legislators and get them to sponsor one.
You know, it's sort of weird, though. In effect, what you're saying is that the First Amendment by itself isn't good enough. It almost needs to be supplemented by saying, oh, and the First Amendment applies in case there's an emergency. Oh, and the First Amendment applies in these other circumstances. I'm just sort of just pushing back a little bit. Just wondering your thoughts.
You're correct on that. The First Amendment by itself should be enough, but sometimes if you put a little clear wording like that into the act, then they realize that they can't violate the First Amendment.
Think about this. What if when the founders, you know, wrote up the Constitution, what if they said something like, and of course here in the United States, we believe marriage is between one man and one woman. Oh, and when we say we the people and we talk about our posterity, that includes the people who are unborn. They're not even born yet. They are in the womb. They are in utero. In other words, if they had spelled out all these things, they could have, you know, avoided all these constitutional crises that the liberals have imposed through judicial fiat, like abortion on demand or same-sex marriage or losing your religious freedom.
Yes, however, the more you do that, the more specific you make the Constitution, the more room you give for exceptions and so on. And so sometimes the Constitution needs to be more general and then let the courts work out the exceptions. But that's one of the reasons why this provision was necessary, is that the courts many times that take the position, yes, there can be no establishment of religion, there can be no interference with free exercise of religion, unless there's a compelling interest or unless we have a substantial need or other things like this. And so that's why having a provision like that, like they have in Louisiana, was very important and very helpful. Anyway, in the state court, the state Supreme Court threw out the charges. They said that the governor had exceeded his authority in issuing that order. The court noted, first of all, that the state and the governor were not treating churches equally. Rather, they said, look, you have a restriction here. No more than 10 people can gather and worship. Now, you don't have a restriction at Walmart that no more than 10 people can shop or any other establishment like this, but uniquely to churches, no more than 10 people can worship. And so they said this law discriminates against religion. That being the case, they said that it'd be under what they called a strict scrutiny test and had to be struck down. So they struck down the governor's orders, at least it applied in that circumstance. And so they threw out all the criminal charges against him. And that, in a sense, is a victory. But we thought it wasn't a sufficient victory, that we needed to go further than that. Because simply to say that the church is to be treated equally is not enough. He looked at the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law inhibiting the free exercise of religion. It doesn't say anything about free exercise of shopping or business or sports or anything else. Free exercise of religion. In other words, religion is not placed in an equal position with other activities. Religion is in a preferred position. And so part of our argument is that, as the court said, we need to start looking back to the intent of the framers. We're saying when you look to the framers, they understood church and state in the way the Protestant reformers understood church and state, and they understood it as it came from the Bible. After all, they're in the 1700s, they're in the backdrop of the Reformation. And you look to the Bible, for example, and even in Old Testament Israel, you see a separation there. The kings of Israel come out of the tribe of Judah, the priests come out of the tribe of Levi, separate offices, separate functions, but both are under the authority of God and subject to the law of God. And we can see similar things in the New Testament when Christ said, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's and unto God the things that are God's. So this idea of separation is a biblical idea. And when you look to the Protestant reformers, they spoke about the two kingdoms, church and state. And these two kingdoms, as Luther said, must be sharply distinguished. And both permitted to remain, and neither is sufficient in the world without the other. We need the church to preach the gospel and to teach the word of God. We need the state to keep order, to defend our shores, to keep criminals off the streets, and to make sure our rights are protected. And these complement each other. If the church is doing its job properly, it's going to produce good, law-abiding, responsible citizens. If the state is doing its job properly and keeping the streets safe, that's going to ensure that the church can preach the gospel. So they complement each other, but they don't interfere with each other. They don't dictate to each other. The point that we make is this. Let us suppose that Pastor Edwards had issued an order saying that all state offices in Louisiana have to close. Well, people would be utterly amazed at that. Where does he think he gets any authority like that? And that's our point. The governor has no more authority to close churches than the pastor has to close state offices. These are separate kingdoms, separate jurisdictions. Anyway, so we filed a petition with the U.S. Supreme Court, petition for cert, we call it, and made these arguments. The court has set this case for conference for the 26th of September. Our understanding is that the court doesn't take a case to conference unless at least one justice says, this is the case we need to discuss. They're at conference. They'll vote on it and probably announce the results later on, but that's when they decide whether they're going to accept the case for full review or not. And certiorari is what we call it. And if four of the nine justices vote to grant cert, as we call it, then the case will be set for a hearing, briefing, and all sorts of things like this. Now, less than 1% of the cases that
okay,
are...
Okay, we have 10 seconds left. Morallaw.org, but finish up in 10 seconds.
If this case is accepted, it could change the whole face of religious liberty jurisdiction in America. So pray for this case. Spell versus Edwards.
All right, and in a positive way. John Eismo, thanks so much. All the best.